take it seriously enough to present it to a class as a respectable philosophical position. No more than I could present intelligent design as a legitimate biological theory. I just cannot take their argument seriously anymore. And if you cannot take something seriously, you should not try to devote serious academic attention to it. I've turned the philosophy of religion courses over to a colleague. So with the exception of things I am finishing now, I am calling it quits with the philosophy of religion. You can debate his conclusion if you want to, but you cannot ignore it coming from such a heavyweight philosopher. I cannot rehearse his reasons here, but only note them. I most emphatically agree with Parsons, of course. In fact, due to the abysmal force of the arguments for God's existence, I have called for the end of the philosophy of religion POR discipline in secular universities. I'm simply advocating the complete secularization of secular universities. My call has received some noteworthy attention and endorsements from Drs. Hector Avalos, Jerry Coyne, Peter Boghossian, and James Lindsay. Avalos is a biblical scholar whose prior call for ending biblical studies is the model I'm applying to the POR. Coyne is an evolutionary biologist. Boghossian is a philosopher and educator. Lindsay is a mathematician. I'm sure that as my call is heard by more atheists, more and more of them will heartily embrace it. There is no reason for the POR as a separate discipline. Science departments should examine any evidence that exists about the origins of nature and the nature of nature, without preference to any ancient pre-scientific writings on the theologies built on them. We should transfer serious discussions about religion and its phenomena over to comparative religion departments. All religion should be treated the same. To have a separate philosophical department dealing with the parochial arguments of Western theistic religion, or Christian theism in particular, already favorably prejudices one religion out of the many global ones that exist. There, I'll have nothing more to say in direct opposition to any of the philosophical arguments to the existence of God. I have no regard for them at all. I'm only interested in knowing whether there is any objective, positive evidence for the existence of a divine supreme being and, lacking that, whether there is any objective, positive evidence for his action in the world. Without this evidence, philosophers of religion are only constructing castles in the sky without any grounding to them. Only after we find objective evidence for God can philosophy help the believer. Specifically, it can help believers define their God after they produce the evidence that he exists. The only way Christianity can be defended is if it turns out there's positive objective evidence for the existence of God and they can come up with a coherent Christian God concept. For even if there is some evidence that a God exists, without a philosophically coherent Christian God concept, the Christian God probably doesn't exist, or at least not the traditionally conceived one. Implications of evolution. The second area not up for debate concerns evolution. Evolution is a fact. Every scientist in every part of the globe knows it is a fact. It is not up for debate. The only thing left for would-be Christian apologists to do, based on the fact of evolution, is to deal with the implications of evolution honestly. Richard Dawkins summed up the evidence for evolution in these words: evolution is a fact, beyond reasonable doubt, beyond serious doubt, beyond sane, informed, intelligent doubt, beyond doubt, evolution is a fact. It is the plain truth that we are cousins of chimpanzees, somewhat more distant cousins of monkeys, more distant cousins still of aardvarks and manatees, yet more distant cousins of bananas and turnips. Continue the list as long as desired. It didn't have to be true, but it is. We know this because a rising flood of evidence supports it. Evolution is a fact. No reputable scientist disputes it. Evolution is based on so much well-founded evidence that it has convinced nearly all Catholic and mainline scholars to support or accept theistic evolution, not just old earth creationism, including many Methodist, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, Unitarian, Congregationalist, United Church of Christ, American Baptist, and community churches. There are even a growing number of people who might be considered evangelical in their thinking, or considered former evangelicals, who have embraced evolution, like Bruce Waltke, a former president of the Evangelical Theological Society, Dennis Venema, a biologist at Trinity Western University, Kenneth R. Miller, professor of biology at Brown University, Dennis Lamoureux at St. Joseph's College, University of Alberta, N.T. Wright, Anglican Bishop of Durham, Francis Collins, Director of the National Institute of Health and Director of the Human Genome Project, Carl Giberson, scholar in residence in science and religion at Stonehill College, microbiologist Richard G. Collins at Olvert Nazarene University, Alistair McGrath, professor of historical theology at the University of Oxford, and Timothy Keller, founding pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City. Then there are Ted Peters, Kenton Sparks, Conrad Hires, Mark A. Knoll, Keith B. Miller, Gordon J. Glover, Howard J. Van Til, Pete Enns, Daryl Falk, Randall Rouser, Victor Reppert, and a growing list of others. The reason why even some evangelical-inclined people are embracing the evidence is because of the evidence. As Jerry Coyne, professor of biology at the University of Chicago, says, every day, hundreds of observations and experiments pour into the hopper of a scientific literature. Many of them don't have much to do with evolution. They're observation about the details of physiology, biochemistry, development, and so on. But many of them do. And every fact that has something to do with evolution confirms its truth. Every fossil that we find, every DNA molecule that we sequence, every organ system that we dissect supports the idea that species evolved from common ancestors. Despite innumerable possible observations that could prove evolution untrue, we don't have a single one. We don't find mammals in Precambrian rocks, humans in the same layer of dinosaurs, or any other fossils out of evolutionary order. DNA sequencing supports the evolutionary relationships of species originally deduced from the fossil record. And, as natural selection predicts, we find no species with adaptations that only benefit a different species. We do find dead genes and vestigial organs, incomprehensible under the idea of special creation. Despite a million chances to be wrong, evolution always comes up right. This is as close as we can get to a scientific truth. For book-length treatment of the implications of evolution, there isn't a better one than Evolving Out of Eden by biblical scholar Robert M. Price and Ed Suominen. Here are a few of the implications. The God hypothesis for the creation of human beings is unnecessary at best. The Adam and Eve story is a myth. Human beings are not special, nor even the highest creation. There was no original pair of humans, so there is no original sin. With no original sin, there is no need for redemption and no need for the second person of the Trinity to die on the cross for our sins. With no need for an incarnation, there is no need for resurrection of the dead either. When we die, we cease to exist, just like every other species does. Christianity itself becomes an unnecessary hypothesis at best. There are other implications of evolution for Christianity. Apart from making its theology irrelevant and unnecessary, probably one of the most important implications is that we can trust science over the ancient scribblings of Bronze Age goat herders who could not possibly have a clue as to the origins and nature of life in the cosmos. With such a monumental finding, it seems reasonable to wait on scientists to tell us the origins of life itself and of the cosmos as a whole. Adam, Eve, sin, and free will. I've written a lot about these topics in my previous works, where I argue that the Adam and Eve story is pure myth, and even if true, it's quite an illogical story, serving no reasonable explanation for the origin of suffering. Having already argued those points, let me additionally argue something based on science. Science teaches us there never was a literal Adam and Eve. There was thus never a historic fall in the Garden of Eden either. That mythical story cannot be taken seriously by any scientifically literate person in today's world. Jerry Coyne tells us, there's one bedrock of the Abrahamic faith that is eminently testable by science, the claim that all humans descend from a single created pair, Adam and Eve, and that these individuals were not Australopithecines or ape-like ancestors, but humans in the modern sense. Absent their existence, the whole story of human sin and redemption falls to pieces. Unfortunately, the scientific evidence shows that Adam and Eve could not have existed, at least in the way they're portrayed in the Bible. Genetic data show no evidence of any human bottleneck as small as two people. There are simply too many different kinds of genes around for that to be true. There may have been a couple of bottlenecks, reduced population sizes in the history of our species, but the smallest one not involving recent colonization is a bottleneck of roughly 10,000 to 15,000 individuals that occurred between 50,000 and 100,000 years ago. That's as small a population as our ancestors had, and note, it's not two individuals. Further looking at different genes, we find that they trace back to different times in our past. Mitochondrial DNA points to the genes in that organelle tracing back to a single female ancestor who lived about 140,000 years ago, but that gene is on the Y chromosome traced back to one male who lived about 60 to 90,000 years ago. Further, the bulk of genes in the nucleus all trace back to different times, as far back as 2 million years. This shows not only that any Adam and Eve, in the sense of mitochondrial and Y-chromosomal DNA alone, must have lived thousands of years apart, but also that there simply could not have been two individuals who provided the entire genetic ancestry of modern humans. Each of our genes coalesces back to a different ancestor, showing that, as expected, our genetic legacy comes from many different individuals. It does not go back to just two individuals, regardless of when they lived. These are the scientific facts, and unlike the case of Jesus' virgin birth and resurrection, we can dismiss a physical Adam and Eve with near scientific certainty. I think with the failure of philosophical arguments to the existence of God and the scientific fact of evolution and its implications, there is no longer any room for faith, especially the traditionally conceived Christian faith. These two non-debatable facts could end the apologetic task all by themselves. There are, however, ways around them, and good apologists, like good lawyers, seem to always find the smallest loophole in the evidence that still allows room for faith. You see, maybe we did evolve, but God chose two Homo sapiens sapiens to test in the Garden of Eden after all. Even though the Genesis text says Adam was created without any ancestry, and Eve was created instantaneously from Adam's rib. Where does the myth end? How does it start? How do we know where it begins and where it ends except as science progresses? If science tells us, then why not just trust science in these matters, dispensing with the biblical text entirely? Others might believe there wasn't an original sin in the Garden of Eden after all. Then where did sin come from? Have we always been infected with it? Then weren't we created as sinners, and if so, how could a good God create us already condemned to die? Or maybe instead we all individually sin once we're born, and then how does God not get blamed for creating humans such that we all eventually sin? If an assembly line keeps producing flawed vehicles, something is wrong with that assembly line. If every human being who has ever born sins, then we are all condemned by virtue of being born, with no other reason to explain our sin except that we are born into this world. Just consider a teacher who gives the same final test to students throughout his or her teaching career, and all students fail that test. The blame for their failure would be with the teacher who created the test. Something is clearly obvious, no matter how we look at it. The fault lies with the creator. Science is also teaching us that sin and the need for salvation are quite likely based on the illusion of free will. We may not like the results of this science, but that is no reason to reject them. These concepts are very problematic given evolution. Humans share 50% of their DNA with bananas. Steve Jones, professor of genetics at University College London, noted this. Do bananas have free will? Can they sin? Can they ever make one single free will choice? If they don't, then do human beings? Does adding more DNA change anything? What would that be? In fact, neuroscience is destroying the notion of free will, sin, and the need for salvation. At the very least, neuroscience is making it extremely difficult for believers to still claim that we freely choose to sin, and we can freely choose to be saved, and that there is a wrathful God who will judge us on the last day. For a case in point, look at just one essay adapted from one book by the neuroscientist David Eagleman, The Brain on Trial. Eagleman writes, "The choices we make are inseparably yoked to our neural circuitry, and therefore we have no meaningful way to tease the two apart. Many of us like to believe that all adults possess the same capacity to make sound choices. It's a charitable idea, but demonstrably wrong. People's brains are vastly different. Who you even have the possibility to be starts at conception. If you think genes don't affect how people behave, consider this fact. If you are a carrier of a particular set of genes, the probability that you will commit a violent crime is 4 times as high as it would be if you lacked those genes, 3 times as likely to commit robbery, 5 times as likely to commit aggravated assault, 8 times as likely to be arrested for murder, 13 times as likely to be arrested for a sexual offense. The overwhelming majority of prisoners carry these genes. 98.1% of death row inmates do. These statistics alone indicate that we cannot presume that everyone is coming to the table equally equipped in terms of drives and behaviors. And this feeds into a larger lesson of biology. We are not the ones steering the boat of our behavior, at least not nearly as much as we believe. Who we are runs well below the surface of our conscious access, and the details reach back in time to before our birth, when the meeting of a sperm and an egg granted us certain attributes and not others. Genes are part of the story, but they're not the whole story. We are likewise influenced by the environments in which we grow up. Substance abuse by a mother during pregnancy, maternal stress, and low birth weight all can influence how a baby will turn out as an adult. As a child grows, neglect, physical abuse, and a head injury can impede mental development, as can the physical environment, and every experience throughout our lives can modify genetic expression. Activating certain genes or switching others off, which in turn can inaugurate new behaviors. In this way, genes and environments intertwine. We are each constructed from a genetic blueprint and then born into a world of circumstances that we cannot control in our most formative years. The complex interactions of genes and environment mean that all citizens possess different perspectives, dissimilar personalities, and varied capacities for decision-making. The unique patterns of neurobiology inside each of our heads cannot qualify as choice. These are the cards we're dealt. The uphold of this science, Eagleman informs us, is that it is difficult to find the gap into which to slip free will, the uncaused causer, because there seems to be no part of the machinery that does not follow in a causal relationship from the other parts. The nature and necessity of conceptions of God. So far, the evidence to believe just isn't there. But what of conceptions of God? Do they fare any better? Julian Baggini and Jeremy Stangroom invite readers to create a do-it-yourself deity in their informative book, Do You Think What You Think? The Ultimate Philosophical Handbook. In two short exercises, they help readers see if their conceptions of God are naturally consistent. If you have never done an exercise like this, you should. Before we can even talk about the existence of the God you supposedly believe in, you must have an intelligible set of consistent concepts about your God. This is not an optional exercise. It's required. Most Christians haven't even thought about this. When discussing any other subject, we must first have an understanding about what we're talking about, some definitions of the terms involved. What conceptions, characteristics, or attributes do you ascribe to the God you believe in? Most Christian theologians follow in the footsteps of Anselm, who asked us to conceive of the greater being than which none greater can be conceived. This theology has become known as perfect being theology, and Christians have struggled to exasperation in defending their conceptions of a perfect being from the changes of incoherence, inconsistency, and unintelligibly ever since. Those who don't adopt it are hamstrung by biblical depictions of Yahweh, the God of the Bible, the God of the Old Testament. Such a God is described by Richard Dawkins in this accurate manner. The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. For anyone who thinks Dawkins was wrong to describe God in this way, Dan Barker, the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF, draws on the Bible's own words to document each of these qualities in a book titled God, the Most Unpleasant Character in All Fiction. I've written a lot about the moral critique of the God of the Bible myself, and I completely agree with this assessment. What we actually find in the Bible is an extremely not-so-good, very bad God. Yahweh, the part of the Godhead in the Old Testament, is exactly as Dawkins described. He's an embarrassment to all decent God concepts. He's focused our attention on Jesus instead. Jesus, the part of the Godhead we find in the New Testament, is representative of love, compassion, and redemption, they tell us. The truth is not as they describe, though, for according to Christian theology, Jesus is one with Yahweh. This is not a good cop, bad cop routine. Yahweh is Jesus, Jesus is Yahweh, in mind, will, and purpose. What Yahweh said and did in the Old Testament, Jesus said and did. Jesus is not a kinder, gentler deity. He's a full-fledged member of the Godhead who shares responsibility for every word, every goal pursued, every action, and every decision of Yahweh in the Old Testament. If Yahweh, the first person of the Trinity, is a moral monster, as the biblical evidence shows us, then so is Jesus, the second person of the Trinity. So it can equally be said that Jesus is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction, jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Starting with the God of the Bible, conceptions of God grew until he became the greatest conceivable being than which none greater can be conceived. James A. Lindsay delightfully and humorously described this trajectory as representing a schoolyard argument among children. My God is bigger than your God. No, my God is twice as big as your God. No, my God is 10 times as big as your God. No, my God is infinitely bigger, better, and more influential than any God you can imagine. Yeah, well, my God is even better than that. Mine's that than which nothing greater can be conceived. Lindsay concludes, these omnis grow through time to the point of sheer ridiculousness. By that point, the unfortunate faithful are left to incredible mental gymnastics to defend physical and philosophical impossibilities in a deity that exemplifies everything people wish it could be and yet that it cannot. In any case, ever since the widespread acceptance of perfect being theology, Christian defenders have doubly struggled to defend their faith, for they now have two nearly impossible tasks. They must first harmonize the bloodthirsty, malevolent Bible's descriptions of the God of the Bible with a perfect being, and then they must also defend the conceptions of the perfect being from the charge of incoherence, inconsistency, and unintelligibility. One task seems quite impossible on its own, but both are now required, thus doubling the problem. Christians have conceptual problems that other theists don't have, for they must intelligibly conceive of a Trinitarian God. This triune God supposedly always coexisted as three persons in one, or, in other views, the Father God eternally created the Son and the Holy Spirit, who never had a disagreement within the Godhead, who never had a prior moment to choose his or her gender or nature, who sent the second person of the Trinity to earth as an incarnate God-man, even though no one has ever made sense of a person who is 100% man and 100% divine, who somehow died on the cross to mollify the wrath or offer satisfaction for the offense of the first and third persons of the Trinity for our sins, even though no one has mollified the wrath of the second person of the Trinity, and even though there is no coherent correlation between the need to punish someone before forgiveness can be offered, who rose bodily from the grave, even though personal identity after death is quite problematic, who subsequently sent the third person of the Trinity to lead his followers into all truth, yet fails in every generation to do this, who will also judge us based upon what conclusions we reach about his existence, paralleling the ancient barbaric thought police, and who will reward believers by taking away their freedom and punish the damned by letting them retain their freedom, lest the saints in heaven rebel and lest the sinners repent in hell and thus no longer deserve their punishment. If you think this description is inaccurate, then read the literature I refer to in this book. According to most conceptions of the perfect being, God is conceived to be all-powerful or omnipotent, all-knowing or omniscient, perfectly good or omnibenevolent, omnipresent, present everywhere, transcendent, exists in a different realm or dimension, immanent, exists in the material universe too, non-material or a spirit, and also a personal agent who both created the universe and acts in it. He's been conceived as immutable, that is, unchanging, impassible, i.e. passionless, without feeling, timeless, doesn't experience a sequence of events, eternally existing with no beginning and no ending, and necessary, not depending on anything else in any way. Are these divine characteristics intelligible? Are they meaningful? Are they internally consistent? Are they consistent with other conceptions of God? Are they consistent with the facts of the universe? Graham Oppie has written a book titled Describing Gods, An Investigation of Divine Attributes, which deals with the coherence and intelligibility of these conceptions of God. Any aspiring apologist needs to deal with this problem, and Oppie's book is a superior work on the topic. There are all kinds of conceptual issues to consider. There are severe problems in conceiving any single attribute of God as well as trying to harmonize them all together, and I only want to call attention to a few of these difficulties here, since the would-be apologist must grapple with them. What are we to think of an omnipotent being? Can he ride a horse he's not riding? Can he create a stone so big he cannot lift it? This second problem is known as the paradox of the stone. It's not escaped too easily. The result of God not being able to do this task is that God ends up being an extremely powerful being, not an omnipotent one. An omnipotent being cannot exist. What are we to think of an omniscient being? Is it possible for a being to know everything that can be known? Can he know everything about himself? Can he know what time it is now? Can he know the future? Can he know future human actions? If so, is the future fixed and unalterable? If it is fixed, can human beings be free if God knows the future? If it isn't fixed, can the past be changed? And if the past can be changed, why doesn't God start all over with a new creation? An omniscient being cannot be ignorant of anything, so any omniscient being would not know something. He could not know ignorance. Can God think? Can he weigh alternatives? If not, he cannot think. Can God know what it's like to have courage? If not, then how could he be considered virtuous, since enduring hardships is considered virtuous? Can God know what it's like to fear something or to worry about the future? If he knows everything, how can he know these things? Can a timeless God act within time? If not, how could he create time at a certain point in time? How could he act at all? How could he do miracles? In addition, how can God be a personal agent if he lacks the kind of things we normally associate with being a personal agent? Can a timeless God be a person, an agent? Can an omnipresent being who exists in all dimensions have a certainty to the divine self, if by definition the divine self would be everywhere? But without a centralized self located in a place and time, how can God be described as timeless, omnipresent, and also a personal agent? Furthermore, how can an omnipresent God know what time it is everywhere, since time is a function of matter in motion, speed, and location? How can God be unchanging or immutable if he is supposedly reacting to the events in the universe and the choices we make? A transcendent spiritual being without a body wouldn't know how to ride a horse, suffer a headache, play football, skate on ice, or run a mile. One attribute of God is known as his simplicity. God is conceived of as a simple being who lacks separate characteristics or attributes, which after everything is said and done is quite revealing of an admission. What it means is that all of these attributes of God boil down to just one. There's only one divine property, divinity itself, and this is identical to God. I kid you not. After all is said and done, God doesn't have the property of omniscience or transcendence or immutability or omnipresence or perfect goodness. Nope. We cannot conceptualize God, it's claimed, since he is beyond comprehension. All of the attributes we might normally conceive God to have are just ways to break up the divine into parts of our understanding. But the bottom line is that God is incomprehensible, according to the doctrine of divine simplicity. Incomprehensible, that is, without a coherent definition, apart from the incomprehensible conception of divinity itself. Incomprehensible, that means something different than humanity itself. In other words, without a positive definition, it means not humanity. Not humanity is describing God in negative terms. Not this, not that. As George Smith says, if God is described solely in terms of negation, it is impossible to distinguish him from non-existence. God is not matter, neither is non-existence. God does not have limitations, neither does non-existence. God is not visible, neither is non-existence. God does not change, neither does non-existence. God cannot be described, neither can non-existence. And so on down the list of negative predicates. I have not argued here for the conclusion that Christians don't have a coherent, consistent, intelligible understanding of a greatest conceivable being. I'm merely informing the aspiring Christian apologist about the problems with convincing God for further research. In the end, though, I agree with George Smith that the attributes of the Christian God are merely a disguise of an elaborate subterfuge designed to obscure the fact that the Christian God is also unknowable. When stripped of its theological garb, the Christian God emerges as the unknowable God of agnosticism. So, Smith concludes, the Christian operating from a conceptual vacuum is defending the rationality indefensible. He cannot even specify what it is that he believes in, or, in more blunt terms, the Christian, when he asserts that God exists, simply doesn't know what he is talking about, and neither does anyone else. Where's the beef? In a 1984 to 1985 Wendy's fast food commercial, a little old lady played by actress Clara Peller asked, "Where's the beef?" So let's finally ask, where's the evidence, the sufficient objective evidence, the beef? I've dealt with this plenty of times before in all my books, so you should consult them if you're interested. From what I can tell, there are plausible natural explanations for every piece of evidence Christian believers use to defend their faith. Religious experiences, consider wish fulfillment. Answered prayers and other paranormal claims, read Theodore Schick Jr. and Louis Vaughn's book, How to Think About Weird Things, Critical Thinking for a New Age. Near-death experiences, consider oxygen-deprived brains. Miracles, read David J. Hand's book, The Improbability Principle, Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day. The Resurrection of Jesus, consider a legend based on visionary experiences that were common at the time. Intelligent design, consider the problem of evil. You'd think there would be something, anything, that would show that the believer has good, solid, objective evidence to believe. There just isn't anything like that at all. Chapter 3. Become an honest, lifelong seeker of the truth. Given that so many billions of intelligent people down through the millennia have been wrong, dead wrong, about so many important things, you should commit yourself to being an honest, lifelong seeker of truth. Given the extremely low odds of being right about everything important, this is the only reasonable, intelligent position to take regarding knowledge of any kind. To be blunt, there are some important things you are sure about, things that you do not doubt, that you're probably wrong about. Let that sink in. You're probably wrong. We all are. Only intelligent or highly educated people know this completely. For the more we know, then the more we know that we don't know. Got that? You should. Daniel Dennett said, "One of the surprising discoveries of modern psychology is how easy it is to be ignorant of your own ignorance. Recognizing one's own fallibility and ignorance is the inaugural point to any honest person's search for knowledge. You'll probably fail to completely realize this until later in life. It may take years or decades for this to dawn on most people. Others may never realize it. They may never be convinced that they have been wrong about some important things. They just happen to get lucky to be raised to believe correctly about everything important. That's all. We should all be so lucky, or something." This commitment to searching for the truth must be brutally honest and maintained throughout one's life. It must be there at the commencement of the would-be apologist studies, too. I think this commitment is of paramount importance. It's so important there should be an initiation ceremony for anyone deciding to be an apologist. Sort of like ordination services, where the ministerial candidate swears to preach the gospel truth, the initiation rite of the apologist candidate should be where aspiring apologists swear to become honest, lifelong seekers of the truth, no matter what the results may be. For only that kind of person with that kind of commitment has a chance to know what religious truth to defend, if any of them can be defended at all. Anyone lacking this kind of commitment should not aspire to become an apologist at all. You probably cannot get any better indicator of that than this. Don't pursue this goal. Drop out now before it's too late. Do something else in life. You are not the right kind of person for this kind of task. It says you are not really interested in the truth, come what may. More often than not, when young college people first decide to become Christian apologists, they have not studied long enough nor plummeted deep enough into the range of issues needed to know which religious truth to defend. It's like getting married at the early age of 21, the drinking age in the United States, and committing oneself to another person for life, not knowing how things will go in the future. It's just too early to expect most of these marriages to succeed in today's world, although it still is a worthy goal. It's just too much to ask of would-be apologists to defend what is believed at the age of 21, too. So the better commitment is to become a lifelong honest seeker of the truth by far. In this chapter, I'm going to offer some sound advice for would-be apologists, or anyone for that matter. Since the goal of any apologist worthy of this title is to defend the truth, such a person should first of all be committed to an honest, lifelong search for the truth, no matter what the results may be. Don't trust your brain. My first and probably most important piece of advice is not to trust your brain. It will deceive you if left unchecked. Does this sound like contradictory advice? After all, I'm trying to reason with your brain by telling your brain not to trust itself. No self-respecting brain would ever fall for that, right? If this advice is considered the cure, then the cure is worse than the disease, correct? Any functioning brain will object to this advice, yes. Not so fast. My advice is not contradictory at all. I should be more specific, though. Your brain does not work that well at getting to the truth. It needs help. It needs better inputs, the objective inputs of science. Without these objective inputs, it can easily be deceived, for the brain is a belief engine. It creates stories out of random data. It sees patterns where there are none at all by connecting random dots. It will see that which supports its own conclusions and ignores that which doesn't. Your brain will believe and defend what it prefers to be true and what is familiar, over evidence to the contrary. It can even justify what it concludes in the face of something incontrovertible evidence. In fact, when confronted with contrary evidence, the brain can and will dig itself deeper and deeper into the intellectual trenches of its own making, refusing to budge from what it has previously concluded. Once the brain latches onto an idea, it can be extremely difficult to dislodge that idea from the grasp of the brain. The more important the idea is to the brain, then the less likely it can be dislodged. There is a massive amount of solid research supportive of these undeniable facts. Alvin Plantinga and others talk about cognitive faculties that are not functioning properly. Brain science shows that none of us have cognitive faculties that are functioning properly, or more specifically, they don't function correctly to a large degree. Guy P. Harrison explains how the brain works when confronted with claims counter to its conclusions. If a skeptic disputes a psychic's readings, then the believer's brain is likely to instinctively go into siege mode. The drawbridge is raised, crocodiles are released into the moat, and defenders man the walls. He goes on to explain, the worst part of all is that the believer usually doesn't recognize how biased and close-minded he is being. He likely feels that he is completely rational and fair. It doesn't happen just with fans of psychics. We are all vulnerable to the distorted way of thinking. This process happens whenever the brain feels threatened by contrary data. What Harrison says accurately reflects the current state of science on the brain, so don't trust your brain. Don't trust it when evaluating philosophical arguments without the hard evidence. Don't trust it when considering conclusions that are near and dear to your heart without the hard evidence. The nearer and dearer to your heart, then the less you can trust your brain without the hard evidence. Even with the hard evidence, the brain can and will deceive you. Your brain will try to deceive you about what it is to be considered evidence. It will try to trick you into thinking the lack of contrary evidence is positive evidence for what it wants you to conclude. Truth is, the lack of evidence is the lack of evidence. It neither affirms nor supports any conclusions all by itself. Your brain distorts and deceives. This we all know. We know this without a shadow of doubt. We know this based on a whole host of recognizable cognitive biases. Those annoying glitches in our thinking processes that produce dubious decisions and mistaken conclusions. Here's what I mean with just two easily recognizable examples. I have seen intellectuals, extremely reasonable people, defend themselves, the family members, and their personal friends from personal attacks with such stupidity that it even makes a guest on the Jerry Springer show look good. The reason is that when people are emotionally engaged, they usually cannot reason very well, even intellectuals. They are in a protective mode. They seek to defend themselves, their family, and their friends from being personally attacked at all costs, even if it means they must sacrifice their intellectual integrity to do so. They don't even see that's what they're doing. We see the same phenomenon when people are in love. It's really true that love is blind. Love is blind to the faults of the person loved. Others who are watching the lovers, who are detached objective observers, can see each of their faults, but people in love cannot, or perhaps more precisely, they do not see the faults, but they are dismissed, disregarded, and rationalized away. What I've just described is called motivated reasoning, something we all do as human beings. There are underlying motives for why we reason as we do. Most of the time, they are hidden. The brain does this. Most of the time, again, we know this. Your brain operates in its own. There is no higher judge or arbitrator of how it thinks or what it concludes. While it's usually reliable, there are many times it cannot be trusted. It just keeps on working, grinding out beliefs and justifying them without even caring if it's the truth. It deceives itself. The reason it's so incorrigible is because its primary purpose, if I can even speak this way, is in its own self-preservation. If left to itself, your brain will try to fit all the facts into a grid of self-preservation, a Procrustean bed of its own making. Many times it doesn't care when coming into contact with reality. It only cares if what it concludes helps it to survive. For that's how the process of evolution works, and that's because the brain evolved to act this way. Given that the brain is such a deceiver, how is it even possible to be an honest seeker of the truth as this chapter challenges? The brain doesn't think honestly in the first place. Its main function is to endure in a dog-eat-dog world where only the fittest survive. Coming to honest conclusions is not its main function. Yet there are ways to keep your brain honest. I hope to tell you how to train your brain. It can be done. The brain seems to find truths inadvertently through trial and error. Thinking like a scientist augments the truth-finding capabilities already in the brain. Ask a lot of questions. People who are truly seekers of the truth have their heads filled with questions on a daily basis. As they look around them at nature, at animals, at the sky above and at the sea beneath, they are filled with wonder. The questions come just about as soon as one looks away from one object to another, from hearing one sound to the next, from touching something different, smelling something different, or tasting something different. Children have this natural curiosity. The curiosity is the desire to know, and it produces an astounding array of interesting and potentially fruitful questions. Let's go back to a time before humanity had very many answers to the kinds of questions that honest truth seekers ask. At one time, a child asked, "Why is the sky blue?" An adult answered, "Because God made it that way." "Why did God make it that way?" "Because he did." "Could he have made it red instead?" "Sure, but he didn't for a reason." "What is that reason?" "Only God knows." Think about the perspective of the child and the adult here. The child wanted to learn. The adult already had the answer. The child was seeking knowledge. The adult was not. In this scenario and many others, supernatural answers stop the search for knowledge. If people had continued accepting those kinds of answers, science would never have arisen. We would still be in the dark. We know why the sky looks blue on a cloudless day. It's because molecules in the air scatter blue light from the sun more than they scatter red light. We know this because of science. We studied this because we first asked questions. Honest truth seekers begin with questions. All inquiry begins with honest questions. So ask questions about everything. Question to learn, question to know, question to grow. Thankfully, an ancient Greek scientist named Thales began our quest for knowledge by asking one simple question. What is the source of all things? His answer was water, and he was wrong, given what we now know represented in the current periodic table of elements. So we've learned people don't even have to answer questions correctly, we just need to ask them. If we cannot figure out the correct answer, perhaps others will. Socrates taught us to ask two questions over and over again in his search for the truth. In his day, the sophists were known as wise Greek educators who taught the youth in the 5th century BCE. They debated Socrates over such issues as piety, knowledge, politics, and beauty. Over and over, Socrates would ask them to clarify what they were talking about. The first question he would ask is, "What do you mean by that?" He would also ask another question, "How do you know?" You would be asking these two questions several times a day in various contexts by using different words and sentences. These two questions can lead us to truth. We must first clarify what we're talking about and then search for any evidence that will either confirm or deny a proposed hypothesis. The evidence will subsequently produce a range of probabilities. Go with them. Think exclusively in terms of the probabilities based on the evidence and reasoning about that evidence. Keep in mind there is little, if anything, human beings can know with certainty. So believers who claim to know with certainty that God exists are surely being deceived by their brains. If you want to be an honest seeker of the truth, you must develop the courage to question everything if needed. We don't have to reinvent the wheel, so to speak. Some things we can take for granted, although even those things might deserve to be questioned just in case we got it wrong before. We all hold to an integrated web of beliefs, as they're called. The beliefs located at the center of the web are the surest ones and the most difficult to question or doubt. Those beliefs in the rim or perimeter of our web of beliefs can be easily disregarded if shown false, without affecting anything close to the center of the web. Probably very few of us would ever question beliefs close to the center of our web of beliefs, or need to, but we should be willing to if we're honestly interested in the truth. We need to develop a questioning disposition or attitude. A questioning disposition is a skeptical disposition. Honest truth seekers are therefore skeptics, reasonable skeptics. They seek reasonable, good answers to honest questions. The term skeptic should not be seen as a pejorative or negative term at all. It should be a positive description of thinking people. Every reasonable adult should be a skeptic. We should all be skeptics, scientific skeptics. Skepticism is a virtue, probably the highest intellectual virtue of them all. One might need to distinguish this virtue from a radical skepticism if needed, but a healthier, reasonable skepticism based in scientific thinking weed out the chaff of falsehoods from the flowers of truth. Think like a scientist. If asking questions is the beginning of our quest for knowledge, then thinking like a scientist is the way to gain that desired knowledge. Given that our brains deceive us, we should think like a scientist. Many of us already know how to do that, but when it comes to a bizarre paranormal belief or others, the problem is our brains won't allow us to fairly test our own paranormal beliefs if we have them. Perhaps we should even consider ourselves to be trapped inside our brains and in need of escaping from its clutches if we want to know the truth. The brain can and does hinder us from knowing the truth. If we don't want to train to think correctly, we must therefore think like a scientist. I had a friend that wanted to know more about me from my handwriting. She had a deck of handwriting sample cards by Bar A. Baggett called the Graphodeck Handwriting Trait Cards. Unlike the science of handwriting, when handwriting samples are compared to determine or exclude an author, Baggett's handwriting cards are supposed to determine one's personality. On the back of the deck, it promised we were holding in our hands the most accurate method of discovering someone's true personality. Yep, that's right. Just by comparing anyone's writing to the sample on the card, you get a snapshot of the true personality in seconds. I was writing a book at the time, so I handed her a page I had just handwritten. I was without my computer. I first asked her the important question of how the cards could predict people's character traits based on their handwriting. Where's the science in that, I asked. Where are the scientific studies showing these cards accurately can do this? She didn't know any. A scientist would want to know how the samples and personality traits were determined in the first place. So all someone has to do is ask to see the scientific studies. If they were not done, there is no reason to trust these claims at all. End of story. Anecdotal personal testimonials simply will not do here, nor would they do in similar cases like one's daily horoscope prediction, psychic readings, answered prayers, or claims of a miracle. Finding someone who says, "I had a miracle," just does not cut it. We must test claims like these if we want to break free from a brain that will deceive us and hucksters and con artists who will fool us. We need scientific studies, clinical studies. They are probably the only way to find the truth given that the brain lies to us. My friend proceeded anyway by taking card samples out of the deck of cards to find my personality characteristics from any matches. On each card was an example of a handwritten letter or words along with descriptions of a personality characteristic. She proceeded to go through the deck and found no consistent matches. None. I was just as surprised as she was. There were a few that were close, but no cigar, as they say. For some reason, when I was learning to write at an early age, I was not required to use consistent handwritten letters. I knew that sounds strange. I write the letters L or T or B differently depending on the letters that precede it, or the letter that comes afterwards. Sometimes I'll start a word with cursive script and then abruptly stick to a block capital letter or two, and even end the word with block letters. My handwriting is a jumbled hodgepodge of inconsistent lettering, and the deck of cards didn't take into consideration that variable. It turned out my handwriting sample was too large of a sample to use. It was only supposed to be one or two sentences per the instructions. Because I submitted a whole page, it was clear there was no consistent pattern of handwriting to discover, so no particular personality traits could be predicted. That was a big flaw in the cards. People should submit a large handwriting sample, since the larger the sample, the more accurate the results. Puzzled at this, she wondered aloud what a handwriting expert friend of hers might say about this odd result. That's when I made a prediction. I predicted that if she gave my handwriting sample to her expert friend, showing no hints or matches, then all bets would be off at this point. He could easily say any number of things that could not be verified. He could say I was an amazing, one-of-a-kind person unlike anyone else, or he could say I was a terrible person, or that I was the funniest man alive or the most intelligent. There would be no controls on what he could say. It was then that she realized the card experiment was flawed, since she knew I was right, but I was just thinking like a scientist. I asked important questions that a scientist would ask. I asked for scientific evidence. I made a prediction that would surely have been realized, and she knew it. There were plenty of ways to think like a scientist. Test everything important. Observe. Look for sufficient objective evidence. Consider alternative hypotheses. Include a null hypothesis in any experiment. Remember that correlation does not entail causation. Avoid any and all logical fallacies. Make predictions based on the evidence and see if those predictions turn out to be true. Think exclusively in terms of the probabilities. If after testing an idea it passes muster, then assign a probability level to it and accept it into our brains as knowledge. Assign a lower probability to that which fails to pass sufficient muster. The process can be long, but it works best if we honestly want to know the truth. There are a few superior books that can help train your brain to think like a scientist written by Carl Sagan, Michael Shermer, Joe Nickel, Guy P. Harrison, David J. Hand, Michael McRae, and co-author Theodore Schick Jr., and Louis Vaughn. And I highly recommend. If you want to think like a scientist, you need to read the books written by these authors. In fact, I'll say your search for the truth should begin with their books. You should also get rid of the notion that scientists are out to destroy your faith. To think like a scientist is to intensely desire to get at the truth, period. As Guy P. Harrison said, thinking like a scientist is the gift that keeps on giving. It's a never-ending process of discovery. New information is always coming in, or will if your brain is open to it. Becoming a generalist. We live in an era of specialization. It seems as though every scholar must specialize in something if he or she wants to make a contribution to knowledge. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. I'm a generalist. It's my specialty. I'm attempting to know as much as I can about all things Christian and related fields of study. No matter how much I read, I cannot do it. So I limit myself to the important things one should know. Someone, some individual, must try to grasp as much about Christianity as humanly possible. That has been my goal. I know I fall short, as would anyone, but attempting to do this has greatly affected how I view the Christian faith. It has led me to become a non-believer. That's the result of my research for the truth. Regardless of where I've ended up in my quest for truth, if you really want to know the truth about your faith, you should become as much of a generalist as you can. Christianity has way too many specialists who don't know that much outside of their own specialty, and so one Christian scholar in philosophy may be almost totally ignorant about recent research in biblical studies, and vice versa. But each Christian scholar in his or her specialty will assume that other Christian scholars in their respective fields of study know what they are talking about when defending their faith. The specialization within Christian biblical studies, theology, philosophy, and science helps perpetrate bad apologetics. Take, for instance, so-called scientific creationists, an oxymoron. They will read only evangelical commentaries on the Bible and then use their knowledge of science to defend creationism precisely because they are not biblically literate. If they were biblically literate, they wouldn't think the creation stories are to be taken literally, but mythically instead. Their efforts in science are then used to reinforce this evangelical creationist biblical scholar's efforts to demonstrate that their Bible is literally true, even though they in turn are not scientifically literate. Consider next the philosophical defense of evangelical Christianity by Alvin Plantinga. He is a brilliant thinker and philosopher, but he doesn't know much of anything about biblical scholarship, not enough about the science of evolution. It's actually made the argument that Plantinga is an example of a brilliant person who is made to look stupid because of how he defends his faith. He doesn't know that much in other disciplines of learning. He leans on other evangelical scholars who don't know that much about epistemology or the philosophy of religion, his expertise. They end up bolstering each other's arguments, even though they don't know that much outside their own areas of expertise. Plantinga, an evangelical philosopher, will argue his faith is rational, but it is rational only in the context of results provided by evangelical biblical scholarship, something Plantinga doesn't know much about, and vice versa. Dr. Jacob Gericke, however, who has PhDs in both the philosophy of religion and the Old Testament, calls Plantinga's philosophical defense of Christian faith little more than fundamentalism on stilts. For as philosopher Stephen Law said, anything based on faith, no matter how ludicrous, can be made to be consistent with the available evidence given a little patience and ingenuity. Sometimes it takes a generalist to see bad arguments for what they are. A generalist can better evaluate the case for or against Christianity than specialists can. Evangelical biblical scholars depend on evangelical philosophers even though they themselves are not philosophically literate. New Testament evangelical scholars are not experts in the Old Testament and vice versa, but their scholarship reinforces one another. They read mainly inside the box of their given specialty and don't read widely outside of it. They simply trust each other's scholarship outside their own expertise, and on it goes. When it stops, no one knows. This is a vicious circular system. Christian apologetics itself needs to do better than this if it wants intellectual respectability. Don't just be a specialist, then. Be one, yes, but strive to be a generalist, too. As a generalist, you need to think outside the box, read books and attend lectures that are outside the box of your comfort zone, outside of your specialization, written by liberals, skeptics, and atheists, but also by others defending other religions. Compartmentalization is the problem when it comes to arriving at the religious or non-religious truth. One needs to read widely in areas related to science, philosophy, archaeology, psychology, Old and New Testaments, religion, and theology. Read outside the box in a wide assortment of areas. More than anything, think outside the box of your brain. Fear not, all truth is God's truth. If your God is as you believe him to be, you should not fear honestly searching for truth wherever it can be found. Don't let your brain fool you about this by instilling fear within you. Many Christian thinkers have argued that all truth is God's truth, so act on it. One of the best statements of this is found in a book by Arthur F. Holmes titled All Truth is God's Truth. Truth can be found everywhere that truth can be found. Since one never knows exactly where the truth can be found, we should not be afraid to search for it everywhere. If something is true, it comes from God no matter where you find it, according to Christian theology. Whether it's found through science, philosophy, psychology, history, or experience itself, all truth comes from God because God is the creator of all truth, says Christian theology. Following this reasoning, there is no secular/sacred dichotomy when it comes to truth. There isn't even such a thing as secular knowledge, if one means beliefs that are justifiably true. Neither sinful nor carnal nor secular knowledge exists because it isn't true, which is the prerequisite for calling something knowledge in the first place. If something is not true, it is false, and there is no such thing as false knowledge. There is only true knowledge. To call something knowledge is to call something true. All knowledge is truth, and all truth is God, since he created it. All truth is therefore sacred upon Christian assumptions, and it all comes from God, whether learned inside the pages of the Bible or outside of them in the various disciplines of learning. Since one can find knowledge outside of the Bible, it follows that the Christian apologist must try to harmonize all knowledge. The defender of Christianity must argue that the Christian faith is what best interprets these other truths. The lessons learned outside the Bible in other areas of learning must be harmonized within the best exegesis of the Bible it can follow. If a conservative understanding of the Bible must give way to the truths learned outside the Bible, then so be it. Truth is still truth. Above all, seek truth. Don't seek to defend anything less. The perfectly acceptable Christian idea that all truth is God's truth was the middle ground that pushed me into finally accepting that the sciences can be better trusted to tell us the truth about life in this universe than God's so-called revelation in the Bible. The truths outside the Bible forced me to reinterpret the Bible over and over until there was no longer any basis for believing in the Christian faith. At some pivotal point along the way, it becomes obvious that I should interpret the Bible through the lens of the sciences, rather than the other way around. In so doing, I accidentally discovered how to circumvent my lying brain. Practice the intellectual virtues. Aristotle discovered the kind of virtues that led to knowledge, and they have been discussed ever since with some additions. They are known as the intellectual virtues, which are good habits of the brain, leading it to become a better instrument for gaining knowledge. If anyone really desires to train the brain, he or she must adopt these virtues or habits. They include the virtues of intellectual honesty, integrity, perseverance in pursuing truth, fair-mindedness with the data, humility in recognizing one's limitations, empathy in pursuing oneself in the place of others to better understand them, objectively assessing arguments and others. We need to train the brain to function properly. Never forget this. We need to force it to think correctly, to think rightly, which in turn will allow us to come to true conclusions. Nothing else will do. In what remains in this chapter, I want to focus on just two of these intellectual virtues. Then I'll conclude by mentioning a few intellectual vices, those habits of the mind that should be avoided because they thwart and hinder the truth. Courage. By reading this book, any would-be apologist has already shown some measure of courage. It takes some courage to entertain the ideas that are outside of one's comfort zone, so congratulations. I know of a woman who wanted to read one of my books, so she said a prayer not to be deceived by Satan before every reading session. Okay, I guess. Is she to be congratulated too? Only a rare number of Christians would even consider reading non-Christian points of view with an open mind. My guess is that most would-be apologists who read this book are not doing so primarily to learn from it, but rather to refuse it if possible. That's two different intellectual attitudes, isn't it? One seeks to learn, the other seeks to rebut. If you're reading this book primarily to rebut it, then you're not really seeking the truth. Your brain is in defensive mode, a mode of operation that has a proven track record of deception. You're not actually being courageous either. You're forgetting that everything should be approached as if it has something to teach you, since you're looking for the truth wherever it can be found, no matter what the result. Remember, if all truth is God's truth, you never know where the truth can be found. I understand some ideas may seem just too far outside of your comfort zone. Some of them may sound bizarre on the surface, like atheism. However, there have been a great many ideas in the past that turned out to be true that were at one time considered bizarre. So courage requires us to explore uncharted territory in hopes of finding the truth. There would be no Columbus without courage, no Marco Polo either. The truth just may be there if we search for it, even if certain ideas sound strange. One thing is that since atheists are growing in numbers, atheism cannot be considered bizarre anymore. More and more scientific thinking people are embracing it. It's a serious option for reasonable people. It's probably the wave of the future bearing some environmental disaster or large-scale war. Courage means reading this book with the primary goal of searching for the truth. If you disagree with it, then argue against it. But for the first question of honest seekers of the truth, it is to ask what can be learned from it. It takes courage when considering ideas outside one's familial or social ties. Your brain will probably lie the most to you when it comes to these familial or social ties. One must have the courage to buck any and all peer pressure coming from family, friends, and church grouping. Truth for the courageous person is paramount. It must be if you want the truth. That doesn't mean you'll end up rejecting any person you love. It just means you really, honestly, sincerely, intensely, stubbornly, doggedly desire to know the truth and will pursue it regardless of what anyone else might think of your journey or your destination. Since the fittest survive, we have learned to depend on the closeness of our own species and our own people within our species to help us survive. We depend on people in our group to help fend off others in the out-group. We depend on close people in our lives during times of trouble or tragedy. So conforming to the opinions of our particular in-group keep us within the group safety net, with group assistance and privileges, rather than being ostracized or banned to fend for ourselves in a brutal red-and-blood predatory killer-be-killed world. So our brains trick us into accepting and defending whatever the group thinks. It's called groupthink for a reason, and we all do it. But if you really want to force your brain into submission, if you really want to know the truth, you should be courageous enough to disregard what people close to you think. If it's required, and if this means disregarding what most people you know think, you should be courageous enough to think for yourself. Open-mindedness, or doxastic openness. You must be the kind of person who is brutally honest by being willing to change your beliefs. If, after considering the evidence for differing ideas, your beliefs are shown wrong. This takes a great amount of courage, so much courage that few people have it, especially when it comes to important beliefs like one's religion. As difficult as it is to do this, I would say you should be happy to be shown wrong. I know your brain won't like it one tiny bit. It prefers that you think you are right about everything. It hates being wrong. Even more than that, it hates having to admit it was wrong, with a passion. Psychologist Dr. Cordelia Finn tells us, "The brain evades, twists, discounts, misinterprets, even makes up evidence, also that we can retain that satisfying sense of being in the right." But if you want to be unshackled from the dictates of your evolved brain, this is what you should desire. When examining some claims of debating with someone over an important issue, your attitude should be expressed in these words. Show me I'm wrong, please. I'm stuck with this belief and cannot shake it. I want to know if I'm wrong. In many ways, this is what the Socratic method of asking questions is all about. Just like the TV detective Columbo, who asked questions to discover the truth by weeding out the bad from the good, you should also ask simple but penetrating questions. If the answer seems satisfactory, you should be willing to honestly embrace those answers. If, however, you don't have the requisite knowledge to offer responses, then be genuine and authentic, as Peter Boghossian urges us. Don't pretend to know more than you actually know. That's a sign your brain is lying to you, disingenuously defending what you think even though you cannot answer a question. An honest seeker of truth will be found to say, "I don't know," rather than mindlessly quote mining a Bible text as an answer. Or my personal favorite, talking about quantum mechanics as if one knows what is being talked about. Very few people understand quantum mechanics. Now, it's a fact that people think they're exactly the type of person I'm describing, courageously open-minded. If you think this of yourself, then mentally say yes right now before reading further. This is a buffer sentence to remind my readers to first answer my question before proceeding. If you said yes, you are almost surely wrong. It is emphatically the case that you are not an open-minded person. It's yet another bold-faced lie coming from your brain, which is naturally closed-minded. Fine wrote a chapter in her excellent book, A Mind of Its Own, How Your Brain Distorts and Deceives, with the title, The Pig-Headed Brain. She tells us, research shows that our stubbornness is so pernicious that even the most groundless and fledgling belief enjoys secure residence in our brains. Later, Fine tells us how bad the human brain really is when it comes to the truth-seeker advice I've given in this chapter. She tells us our problem is that we are convinced that we are already doing this. It's simply that the other guy's view is absurd, his argument laughably flimsy. Our pig-headedness appears to be irredeemable. Boy, that's encouraging news, right? The one thing everyone should acknowledge is that none of us are open-minded, none of us. Anyone who doesn't acknowledge this fact is either ignorant of the evidence or closed-minded to it. But once we realize that our brain does, then we can become more and more open-minded. We can train our brain to ask questions and think scientifically once we learn it deceives us. This isn't completely different from being convinced a particular teacher of ours cannot be trusted. For as soon as we realize this, we will begin questioning what he or she teaches us. At that point, we will seek verifying everything. We will study questions for ourselves using the most reliable means.